We've been looking at the Psalms and understanding the variety of different kinds of Psalms that are present in the whole collection of the Psalter. Today we're going to take a look particularly at the Royal Psalms. Remember again that there are at least 8 different kinds of Psalms, and different scholars have different ideas about whether there are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Some of these can be considered part of different collections, and some collections actually indicate that we might have others to look at as well. So take a look at each of these that are possible, the different types of psalms. And today we're going to focus on those that particularly show what happens in terms of Yahweh's relationship with Israel, and especially after the time that David was anointed as king, with the unique covenant authority that he and his descendants forever would be on the throne of Israel. Now, of course, that didn't happen in history because David eventually died and all of his descendants, some of them sat on the throne, but then there came a time when kings were no longer allowed in Israel because of the fact that other nations were in control, Babylon or Persia or Greece or Rome. And that's where the uniqueness of the royal psalms comes in, because there's an understanding that God will always have someone from the family of David give leadership to God's people. Now, how is that possible? This becomes one of the key themes of the New Testament, where Jesus is understood to be a son of David in the royal family, and he, of course, having gone through death and raised to life again, lives forever and is ruling as King of Kings and Lord of Lords forever and ever and ever. And that allows the themes of these psalms related to both God's rule in Israel and God's eternal rule through a son of David in the family of faith, that is the New Testament church as well, to continue to be expressed forever and ever and ever. Now, there aren't as many of these royal psalms as there are of some of the other kinds of collections in the Psalter. These are songs of praise about Yahweh, who is true king of Israel, but also about the monarch in the family of David who rules on Yahweh's behalf among the people. And those stories are told in 1 and 2 Samuel, where the people of Israel, after the days of the judges, felt as if they were not able to find direction for day-to-day activities, particularly with regard to the pressures from other nations, and wanted to have a king that they could see. And remember that in this requesting and feedback through the prophet Samuel, at first there was a lot of divine and certainly Samuel's own pushback to the idea, but eventually God said, this is exactly what the people need, and this will work out to our mutual benefit. Saul was the first king, and Saul's reign started out well, but then it ended in kind of a variety of mishaps. David was then anointed, and later on David was affirmed as the king after God's own heart, and he was given the go-ahead to initiate the process for the building of the temple and a promise that his descendants would rule forever on the throne. Some of the psalms that are royal psalms, Psalm 2 is a perfect example of it. Notice the political overtones of this psalm. The psalm reads as this: why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, you are my son, today I have become your father. Ask me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron, you will dash them in pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss his son, or he will be angry, and your way will lead you to destruction. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. And notice these things about the psalm. Yahweh, the Creator, who is the partner to Israel, is understood as the father of the king on Israel's throne. That's a very important concept. God is Lord over all nations. God has a special relationship with Israel. And God has a unique relationship with the king who now rules visibly as the leader of the people. Yahweh is the leader of the people, but the person who is on the throne in Jerusalem is the visible expression of that. In this sense, the theocracy of that Israel has as its guiding mission and mandate and its political self-understanding is affirmed. And its relationship with the nations all around it is defined. Although Israel is only a small tribe, a small group among all of the nations geographically, if you look at a map, you'll see that the land of Canaan or the land of Palestine is so small in comparison to the other nations around it that it almost disappears from the map. Still, it is considered by God to be the central and key figure in the political fortunes of all the world. That's a very interesting concept. What happens to Israel happens to God, and what happens through Israel is for the benefit and blessings of the nations who all belong to God. The psalm itself is built in a broad chiasm. Remember that chiasm, and we're going to look at chiasm more specifically, so keep these things in mind. Chiasm is the idea that elements of the statements in the various synonymous parallelism near the beginning reoccur near the end, that there's a kind of parallelism of larger ideas across the middle point of the poem or the story or the psalm, and that there's a reverse order to them. So something that happens near the beginning happens near the end. The next thing happens second in the beginning and second to the end, a reverse order between first and second halves. And so you have that here where the first major section is verses 1-3 describing the rebellion of the rulers of the earth against the rightful rule of Yahweh, who is the creator of all. The creator has an obligation to and a responsibility for all the nations of the earth. And that section is paralleled in the last verses of the psalm, verses 10-12 at the end, in which these rebellious kings are urged to worship God and to honor God's earthly regent, the king on the throne of Israel. So you see the challenge up front and the call to submission at the end. And then in between those are two other paralleled parts. The second major section is in verses 4-6, and this describes Yahweh's plans for the establishment of the kingship of Israel, regardless of what all the other nations are planning to do, what they might seek to bring against it, what rebellions they might foment, what projects they have against it. Yahweh is going to do what Yahweh is going to do. And then the paralleled section with that, second to the end, is in verses 7-9, in which the authority of the king of Jerusalem is affirmed and established. So God tells us what God's going to do in that second section, and in the third section, God does what God intended to do. So the point of the psalm is to affirm the validity of the king who rules on the throne of David, the king in Jerusalem. This king is intended to be God's ruler, not just for Israel, but for all the nations of the earth. Thus, Israel, in this larger theological framework, is God's earthly partner in the divine mission to reclaim and to bless all the nations of the earth. And the Davidic king who's on the throne is divinely appointed to serve those ends. This is the theological purpose behind the political plans and activities of the nation. And that's why the New Testament apostles understood this psalm. They used it in Acts 4 when they were being persecuted locally in Jerusalem. They saw this psalm as foretelling Jesus, the last and greatest son of David, to rule over the nations. So all of these things come together. They make sense within the Old Testament context, but they also make sense within the New Testament context as Jesus fulfills the things that are left unfulfilled in time and earthly history. Another example of a royal psalm, Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. For he founded it upon the seas and established it on the waters. Who may ascend to the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? Here we have some things again similar to Psalm 15. Then notice how the psalm ends. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and lift them, you ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is he, this King of glory? The Lord Almighty. He is the King of glory. A very interesting thing. Again, synonymous parallelism throughout the psalms, something you ought to pay attention to as you read the psalms. These ideas constantly reiterate and reaffirm the key ideas in each meaning context. Notice that the psalm begins with an affirmation about the global, universal rule of God, but then it moves on to the royal procession ascending the throne in Jerusalem. See how those things are tied together. God is ruler over all the nations. Here comes the king to Jerusalem. Wham! The two are tied together. So the psalm deliberately leaves vague the location of the ultimate throne. Is it the Ark of the Covenant at the temple, which is considered to be the throne of God on earth among Israel? Or is it the throne of David in the human palace right next door? The answer doesn't need to be given, for these two thrones are essentially one and the same. God, the King of heaven and Lord of the earth, is represented by the divinely appointed Son of David on Israel's national throne. The mission of God is to bless all nations, and it happens in a very real way through the success of the Davidic king on the throne. So the psalm praises the ruler of Israel. Who's the ruler? God and the king, both together. Another fascinating royal psalm is Psalm 110. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your troops will be willing on your day of battle, arrayed in holy splendor. Your young men will come to you and take from the morning's womb. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will crush the kings in the day of wrath. He will judge the nations, heaping up the dead and crushing the rulers of the whole earth. He will drink from a brook along the way, and so he will lift his head high. A bit of a strange psalm in a number of ways, but it is a psalm of David, and it celebrates an authority which lies outside of and above the Levitical priesthood. Now, the Levites and the priests who are part of the Levites were seen to be the central characters in Israel's leadership. Levi was the tribe of Moses and Aaron. And so the priests and the Levites emerge from the tribe of Levi or become the caretakers of the leadership of the people. Still, what happens with David, who's from the tribe of Judah, is that his authority is derived not from the usual system, which shows the leadership mandate originally come through Moses at Mount Sinai. Here, there's a sense in which God has a separate, larger leadership mandate, which emerges through a different channel. And the greater authority is based on the person and idea of Melchizedek. Melchizedek hardly appears in the Bible. He's only a footnote in the Old Testament, couple of verses in Genesis 14, where Abraham has rescued his nephew Lot and has defeated the kings who came up against them. And on the way back home, Abraham stops to offer a sacrifice of thanks, and the king of Salem is a priest of the Most High God. His name is Melchizedek, king of righteousness, and he's the one that allows or enlists or helps Abraham to do these things. So here's Abraham and the entire system of Israel, including the Levites who emerge from his descendants, using an outside system to bring sacrifice to God. So in essence, through Abraham, Israel offers sacrifices to God through the ministry of Melchizedek, so there's a greater authority. This theme of the greater authority is picked up by this psalm, and then again in Hebrews 8 through 10 in the New Testament to explain the unique authority of Jesus as the high priest and divine ruler who has an authority outside of the Levitical priesthood system. Very interesting things to think about as we look at the royal psalms. These psalms altogether assert the link between God's rule over the whole world and the unique role that the king of Israel plays in God's mission through the nation itself. God rules, but God's reign is exerted through Israel's king and Israel's place among the nations. So the king of Israel is the representative for God among the nations. Thus, the king must live a righteous life, reflecting God's own character, and the righteousness of the people is a reflection of their relationship following the righteous rule of the king. God wishes to connect with all the nations of the earth. God does so through Israel. Israel is on a divine mission, and that divine mission is led by the king on the throne of David. Jesus, of course, will pick up that role once the New Testament comes.